Joining us now on the line is a good buddy, sports professor Rick Caro, as it's time for our golf and sports business and law segment sponsored by the law firm of McDonald Hopkins in West Palm Beach. And I am not a lawyer. I'm a non-lawyer spokesperson for the law firm of McDonald Hopkins. But Rick is a lawyer. He is also the visiting expert on sports law at Harvard. You can see him each week on both CNN and ESPN. And you can also find Rick's weekly blog and podcast at msn.foxsports.com. And, of course, you can listen to him right here in this very time slot. Happy Sunday, Rick.
Yeah, happy Sunday to you. You know, I'm a lawyer, I know, and a business guy, but I'm also a fan of that Villanova-Pitt game last night.
My God.
Might have been the best game ever in college basketball. I can't remember anything better than that. That Duke game of years ago might have fit. You know, I talked to Michael Lippman, who chairs ticketsofamerica.com, and they're one of the big ticket broker sales entertainment group. He said that that game alone is going to generate so much interest in the Final Four because Villanova is the serious deal. Whoever Villanova plays, whoever wins the North Carolina-Oklahoma game plays Villanova at the first round in Detroit. And it's set up to be a great Final Four, but that clearly was one of the best basketball games ever.
Absolutely. It was a phenomenal game. There's no doubt about it, the Pitt-Villanova game last night, the best game of this year's tournament by far. And they're both, and go figure, they're both Big East teams, and they were so balanced. You know, one thing that I noticed with some of the teams that bowed out a couple of rounds early, like maybe a Duke or a Missouri yesterday, Memphis as well, is that really they were strong in one aspect but maybe weak in another. But both those teams last night, Pitt and Villanova, so balanced, you know, guard play is so important come tournament time, and both those teams have strong guard play, but they also are strong in the middle. I mean, DeJuan Blair is such a strong presence for Pittsburgh in the middle. Same thing for Villanova. But Villanova, again, they, you know, guys like Scotty Reynolds on the outside, they're so strong in both aspects. And those teams are so evenly matched, there's no doubt, there's no wonder that it was a two-point game, 78-76, but it was great. They were going back and forth, and the lead must have changed five or six or seven times, and it was a lot of fun. Too bad that Pittsburgh can't as well go to the Final Four, but that's the way it goes. And one team had to win, and one team had to lose, and that's the way it turned out last night.
Yeah, and you know, you talk about student-athletes and classy programs and all. I watched the press conference last night before my couple of radio spots, and of course Villanova was easy to do, but the Pitt press conference with Jamie Dixon, you know what they do in college Final Four and the March Madness is they get the coach and then they get three players and they got to sit up there and they got to take questions whether they win or lose, which is interesting because when you become a pro and you lose a close game, a lot of those pro athletes are out the back door, but they had Blair and they had Young and you know, the top three seniors for the Pitt team sat there, and they weren't effusive, but they're not supposed to be. They sat there as pros.
Yeah, I have a feeling we'll see both those guys, Sam Young and DeJuan Blair, in the NBA. I think both those guys have a game that's that can translate to the next level. So we'll definitely be seeing them again sometime soon, and it's been a great tournament so far. Two teams punching their ticket to the Final Four. I love that phrase. UConn, of course, is a Big East team, and Villanova as well. Should Louisville win today against Michigan State? Three Big East teams in the Final Four, and I think it was 1985, if I'm not mistaken, the last time that happened, and the only time that happened, when three teams from the same conference go to the Final Four. And then, of course, in the bottom half of the bracket, Oklahoma playing against North Carolina today. You know, if Oklahoma wins, they would be the only Big 12 team that would make it. But if North Carolina wins, then your Final Four would be comprised of three Big East teams, should Louisville win today, and an ACC team. And those were the two power conferences on the year. And both those conferences got each of them getting seven teams in the big dance. So I think it would be very fitting if Final Four is comprised of ACC team in North Carolina and three Big East teams in Louisville, UConn, and Villanova.
Yeah, and it becomes a driving Final Four as opposed to a flying Final Four, because all those teams are clustered fairly close together in that scenario. And then we're going to see what happens as far as economic impact. So, you know, next week we're going to do this from Detroit, and we'll talk a little bit about how this kind of event is important for the economy, and we'll have two sets of numbers to look at. One is, I guess, if Oklahoma wins, and obviously if Michigan State wins, that's a drive. If Oklahoma wins, they'll probably fly. Everybody else, get in the car, drive, spend a couple of days. Good economics, but not as good if you have as if you had teams like Gonzaga and all over the country. But listen, it's a great Final Four, and everybody's going to be excited about it this year.
Russ Evans with you, Golf Exchange, presented by the Honda Classic, and we're joined on the line by the sports professor, Rick Horowitz. Our golf, business, and law segment, sponsored by the law firm of McDonald Hopkins in West Palm Beach, and of course, so much more in the world of sports than simply golf, so we try to talk about everything in this segment. And Rick, in regards to a local story, a huge local story that's going to have long-reaching impact for years to come, the Miami City Commission and the Miami County Commission both last week approving the new Marlins $600 million ballpark project. The votes passed. The ground will be broke down there in Little Havana in July, the old Orange Bowl site. And we're going to have baseball in Little Havana at the old OB site starting in 2012.
You mean I can't go to the Orange Bowl and watch the Hurricanes anymore?
No more. No more OB for the Hurricanes. And they're of course, playing now at Dolphin Stadium. They've upgraded their digs a little bit.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe what I should do is spend 20 years of my life trying to get facilities done in South Florida, and maybe one of them will pay off. You know, this was a great history. You could be cynical and say it's not over yet, because any one of the entities can get out of this before July 1. If the financing isn't together, that's pretty cynical. I haven't seen any deal that's been at this level of approval around the country that hasn't actually gotten done. So I'm sure we've passed all of those significant hurdles. But it is interesting, Russ, to talk about how a couple of years ago when people would wheel out economic impact studies and say, yeah, that's stuff that nobody believes, this really is all about stimulus and jobs and planning. And that's the reason why this timing all of a sudden became the right time. You know, in 1930s, historically, it's interesting, 70 years ago, almost to the day, the Orange Bowl was built with WPA money off the heels of the Great Depression, where they spent $11 billion nationally, which was big back then, clearly, to build 2,500 stadiums and 6 million seats for bailing out the economy and stimulating it, and the old Orange Bowl was that deal. And it is interesting, historically, that now we have a new building on the same site 70 years later, driven by the same kind of arguments to move the economy along. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, there have been stadiums built with a lot of public money, Rick, in the past, but there's also been a lot of stadiums built with private money. You've been down here your whole life, and I know that you've been involved with a lot of stadium projects that have been financed from both areas of the community. And in regards to private financing, Joe Robbie built Joe Robbie Stadium with private money in 1987. Obviously, that stadium is now known as Dolphin Stadium. And this project is going to be primarily from the public coffers. And I know there's a lot of detractors not so happy about that. And I think a lot of the people that are bothered by this project and by all the public money going to the $600 million project and very little private money, I think a lot of them have a problem with the way that the financing from the team is coming about. And it's really, there's no money up front from Marlins ownership. And what they're agreeing to in this project, as far as I can tell, and hopefully you can clarify this, is really what amounts to a leasing agreement. And they'll be paying a lease on a yearly basis. But none of the money for this construction is coming up front from the team. So therefore, where is all this money coming from to build this ballpark initially?
Well, it's public money and public risk, with a pretty good, if not guaranteed, likelihood that the private dollars will meet or exceed the projections. And by that I mean, if you're going to open a stadium, you're going to have a minimum amount of revenue. And that revenue is going to go back to the public sectors to pay the Marlins obligation. Now, in a lot of deals around the country, the teams wrote a check for a piece of the deal, and that check was used as part of the financing. In this case, assuming the public sector gets the financing for the team's piece from somebody, then they're okay with it because someone has taken a risk, even if it's not the Marlins. And that's really the case. So you could argue that the Marlins ought to put the money up front, but if they put the money up over time and the county and the city get the bonds sold by private sector who believes in this project, then it's amounting to the same thing. I know it's pretty complicated, and I'm not here defending the Marlins, but it is a deal that's in the range of normal deals around the country. I've kind of stayed quiet on this whole thing in Miami because there's a whole lot of people pointing fingers all over. But I've done a lot of these around the country, and you kind of look at them. And this one is in the range. Most of them don't take 13 years, and most of them don't go through three ownership groups. And most of them are dealt with people who have lived in those cities all their lives as opposed to out-of-towners. And most of the deals don't have two World Series champions, so a lot of people can say, we don't need a new stadium because we win World Series without it. Putting all that aside, this is within the normal range.
Russ Evans with you, Golf Exchange, presented by the Honda Classic, joined on the line by the sports professor, Rick Caro, who has dealt with, as he mentioned, a number of these ballpark projects throughout the years, and he has helped different cities and municipalities build stadiums of all types, whether they're baseball or football stadiums, and also NASCAR stadiums, right? Rick, you were involved with a NASCAR project in the Midwest at one point.
A lot of them, Kansas City, Chicago, there are a lot of those that are public-private, too, and you know, you look at the impact that they generate, and you take the tax money from that impact and you plow it back into the project, and that's the way a lot of these deals are done. That's part of the funding here. That's the way Kansas Speedway was done. That's the way Chicago was done. That's the way maybe 150 of these baseball, hockey, basketball, football arenas and stadiums are done too. And like I said, this one is basically the same kind of cookie-cutter approach.
Rick, just a couple of kind of quick odds and ends before we let you go in regards to economy and the down economy and how sports are becoming somewhat creative to roll with the punches in this down economy. First of all, the NFL, considering allowing teams to have lottery and liquor sponsors, if permitted, this move would obviously generate a new stream of revenue.
Oh, boy, don't touch that because we can't mix gambling and casino ads and, you know, the purity of football. But wait. We don't have any money anymore, so let's reach out and try to do that. You know, $44 million of stadium signage, by the way, goes from casino gambling and Indian gaming, and this is a logical extension. You wouldn't have thought a few years ago that we talk about hard liquor and gambling interest, but now necessity breeds creativity, so you're going to see that pretty soon.
Minnesota Timberwolves owner Glenn Taylor is specifically being hit hard by this down economy. Over the last couple of years, he has seen his net worth decrease by almost one-third.
Yeah, tough for him, 27% since last fall.
And I'd imagine this is kind of the same deal for a lot of these owners with a lot of money and a lot of stakes in different various investments.
Well, not only investments, but a lot of the guys who made a lot of money on real estate, you know, their portfolios are down 15 or 20%, and they can't do anything about it except just wait for the economy to turn around like all of us. I'm sure they're in a little bit better cash flow position than we might be. But the Glenn Taylor statement is public, and, you know, some are going to say, well, are you going to have the same kind of incentive to build your team and sell? All of these guys who have been in business understand that if you're going to stay open for business, you got to try as hard as you can to sell products. So look for guys who are losing a lot of their own worth to dig even deeper in their pockets to try to make sure they keep a competitive team going.
One guy digging deep into his pockets was New York Rangers general manager Glenn Sather. He posted a $1 million bail for former Edmonton Oilers owner Pete Pocklington, who was arrested on bankruptcy fraud charges.
Yeah, God bless the loyalty there. You remember the old Edmonton Oiler Wayne Gretzky dynasties? Well, Pocklington was the owner of that team, and he was a big deal, and frankly, he was a very important hero in Western Canada and hockey lore. And maybe it's that way in other sports, but in hockey administrations, they're very loyal to the people that gave them their first jobs. This was a good case of that.
And then last note that I saw that really struck me as odd and unfortunate, an Iraqi soccer player was shot dead as he was about to kick a goal that would have put his team ahead in the final minute. The suspect is a supporter of the rival club. So here's a guy in a soccer stadium with a gun and shoots a guy on the field dead before he's about to kick a penalty kick.
Yeah, well, it's the economy as well, but they're having some trouble over there that adds to the stress. You know, sports violence is a big topic as well. You think about hockey fighting, you think about fan violence. And you always try to figure out where that line is that separates the players from the fans and what is normal part of the game and what is not. That's what the criminal and civil laws are all about. I think everybody would argue that this kind of thing is nowhere near the way soccer is supposed to be played. And so, you know, you can get a little worked up. This goes a little bit too far.
A little bit too far is definitely an understatement. I mean, you talk about art imitating life and vice versa, life imitating art. I mean, this is like straight out of the scene from that movie, The Last Boy Scout. Remember when the football player is running on the field and he pulls out the gun in mid-run and shoots the players before he gets to the end zone and then he shoots himself? I mean, crazy stuff over there in Iraq and scary. It's very scary.
Crazy scary in Iraq for a lot of reasons other than just a soccer game, as we know.
He is the sports professor, Rick Caro. He joins us each and every week here on Golf Experience. exchange during our golf and sports business and law segment sponsored by the law firm of McDonald Hopkins in West Palm Beach. He is the visiting expert on sports law at Harvard. You can see him each week on both CNN and ESPN. You can also find Rick's weekly blog and podcast at msn.foxsports.com. One note, Rick, before we let you go, we were talking about the Final Four, and this is indeed the first chance since 1985. I had the date correct, and the teams were St. John's, Georgetown, and Villanova. The one of those that did not belong was Memphis State, and they were bounced in the quarterfinal or the semifinals, and then of course the final, Villanova over Georgetown, as we remember Raleigh Massimino, looking so thrilled there. But three Final Four teams from the same conference, we had that chance again this year. Thanks for the time, as always. We're talking Final Four next week, as you're going to be from Detroit.
Absolutely, and I hope the final game is as exciting as that Villanova-Georgetown game was all those years ago. We'll just have to wait and see.
Me too. Thanks, Rick. Happy Sunday, buddy.
All right, man. See you next week.